Colonel Warburton, Reel 7. Now, we've just been looking at the notes, and we know, I see that we've found that you joined the regiment in April 1949, and you now feel it may be that Barber was the person who recruited you, but he wasn't actually at that time formally Colonel. The other key officers, the medical officer, Major MacLeod.
Yes, he was a well-known nose and throat specialist, I believe, in Nottingham.
And his name was Ian?
Yes, he was a very sound asset to the regiment.
And the RSM in 49 was Warrant Officer T. Dunn, and then followed by Dunstan, who the one you might remember better from 1959. What was Dunstan like? RSM Dunstan.
Yes, he was adequate, put it like that.
Not a competent, not that.
Oh, yes, very competent. We have some very good RSM.
What would you say the role of RSM was? You know, just in a territorial unit.
Mainly to keep an eye on the NCOs. Try and help train them. And that's his main job, why we were there. And look after the discipline of the regiment generally.
Now, the other battery commanders, you were 425. 426 was Major Turner, and 520, Major Derbyshire.
Yeah,
what were those two officers like?
Well, Major Turner was, I wouldn't say he was an inspiring officer, but he was a very loyal man. I think he'd been in the war with them, I'm not sure, but I think he had. He was very enthusiastic, put it like that, but he had a lot of bad luck domestically. His wife died, then he married some other woman, and she'd already got about five kids or something, and he took all this lot on, and he's dead now, not surprisingly. And John Derbyshire, I always rather mistrusted him, but he was... not mistrusted him, but he wasn't very experienced. And
that's yeah. Now, the first shortly after you joined 20th of April 1949. Yeah, they went to camp at Otterburn in June to July. Perhaps that would be perhaps one of the first things you remember with them. I wonder whether you remember the Otterburn camp.
We used to go to Otterburn quite often.
You went in 50 as well,
yes.
As a Proteus and Otterburn. Yes. What do you remember of the Otterburn camps? Or if not individually, then collectively, before you became Colonel?
Yes, before I became Colonel. That was more than my first camp.
What do you remember of it? What would you do? What was the nature of the training that you were going up there to get?
Well, the main point of going to Otterburn is that we were able to fire live ammunition. And that's the only time we ever got a chance to fire live ammunition. It was Otterburn, what I very soon discovered, that Otterburn was not really a suitable place for SP guns.
In what way?
Well, because the ground is hot and soft, and they kept getting bogged. And the whole point of an SP gun is you can move across country and get into action quickly with it. And that was the sort of training we were trying to get. And I remember having a frightful argument with people, because we were always having to get something to rinse these things out with the bogs and things. And he said, oh, well, it's good training. I said, well, we haven't come here to practice winch drill. We can do that at home. We've come here to fire the guns, and we can't fire the damn things when they're stuck in these bogs. And eventually we didn't go to Ottman so much while we had SPs, we used to go to Lark Hill.
Was there a problem also with the fault, I mean even more so than Lark Hill, Salisbury Plain, with the crests? Fault?
Well, the trouble with Ottman is it's quite small, quite a small range, and you've got very limited range and very limited arcs of fire. You're very confined when you're there, and when you can't move off the roads except to mark gun position, the whole thing becomes all fault. And I didn't think it was suitable for our purpose at that time at all. I wanted to get them onto somewhere like Salisbury Plain where they could go swanning across the country and then drop into action. You know, a proper role for SP regiments.
And what about the actual other things you did? What else would you practice at Otterburn when you were there, besides the rather inadequate range?
We used to have one day sort of anti-tank shooting, and it was a solid shot. That was quite a change and quite fun, because we could see the shots going. If you have tracer on, you have this business. That's quite satisfactory. It's surprising how quickly, and we used to have one night occupation, which was quite.
What's that? Tell me about that.
You occupy a position completely in the dark, and you have to find a way there in the dark. And this is when I was commanding a battery there, and there was a sort of plane, and we had the night occupation. And it so happened I got to know Salisbury and played quite well, but for one reason or another. And we were told to occupy some position at midnight when it was actually black. And I thought I knew the way to this place pretty well. So I thought, well, follow me. And I set off in the pitch black with all my merry men following. And after we went for about 20 minutes, we heard a sort of rumbling, and coming completely the opposite way was John Darbyshire, and with his master also heading for the same way. So we knew one of them was 180 degrees wrong, and I damn sure I was right, and I said, "Whoa, cheerio," and went on. And eventually he turned out and tagged at my tail and followed me, I'm furious. But that was John Darby, made my point, I think.
Any other sorts of exercises you do?
Well, we took part in a very big, I think it was an army exercise on Salisbury Plain, this was, which was...
Would the Tilshead and West Down camps, would they be also...
That's on Salisbury Plain, very good camp.
And I interrupted there.
I can't remember what this exercise was called. It was a hell of a thing. It went on for 3 days. And we were very, very tired at the end of that. I can't remember what it was called, but it was on Salisbury Plain. It finished up on Salisbury Plain. It started off somewhere inland and then gradually worked up till we got on Salisbury Plain. It was a very great experience. But,
would you get various senior officers visiting you during a camp? I see that GOC Northern Command visited you at Otterburn.
We all came. We all had the GOC at Northern Command. Of course, we had our own.
Who was that at the time? Possibly don't.
Well, we had several. Goodbody. Was that with a note? General Goodbody. And of course, at that time we were in a division, you see, we were in 49th Parabad Division. So we had a division commander who was based in Nottingham.
And what would happen in an inspection of, you know, the camp by one of these senior officers?
There wasn't any formal thing. They used to come when we were firing, and we'd probably meet them in the lines and just show them where we were. And then take them up to the OP and see what was going on there. And then we usually tried to arrange sort of tip me blunt in the OP, and then they'd go home. And then very often if we had a dinner at night, they'd come in for the dinner at night. But there wasn't any sort of having a whole battery lined up and then that sort of thing, or any mark path or anything like that. It was just always in action. We hadn't really a lot of time to do all the things we wanted to do.
Was there any problem in getting time off work for either you or for your men during these summer camps?
Well, a lot of them did have a very great difficulty, and some of them were only able to come for 1 week and that sort of thing. But by and large, we did very well. And from my own point of view, I didn't take holidays at all, and that was my holiday.
Did employees tend to support people? Did employees tend to support people being members of the TA?
By and large, they did, and it was quite a problem, and one can well understand it. If a man expects to be given a fortnight's holiday for camp on top of his normal holiday, it's a great slice out of the year's working. It means he's really only working for 12th of the year. And if he's manning a machine, which many of them were, it means virtually that machine's not working for 12th of the year, which is quite a serious loss for the employer. I don't think people realise what it does involve. And it doesn't always have a good impact on the rest of the staff. Because as far as they're concerned, if you're in camp, you're on holiday. Somebody else is having to do your job. You know, it's horrible. And it did create problems. There's no two ways about it. It still does, I'm sure.
Now, what about drill nights? What were they like? And what would your role be at them?
Well, drill nights...
Where were they held?
Well, they're all held at the drill hall.
Now, which drill hall was it?
The drill hall, yes. Bull Hall in Nottingham.
So they'd stopped using the Derby Road drill hall?
Oh, yes. We stopped using that long ago. Very good drill hall at Bull. It's one of the... what was that fellow's name? Pre-war built a lot of drill halls for TA. They're a very good one. But it consisted of lectures and that sort of thing, and practicing gun drill and in the drill hall and that sort of thing.
How many a week? Just one?
Only one night a week we used to have, and then we used to try and come in most Sundays.
What would you do on Sundays?
Well, we'd sometimes take the guns out, if we could, and go out to protest and do come to action and come out again, and by that time, we'd really ready to come back again. That was the trouble. You know, it was very, very quick affair. But then we did sometimes go for a weekend there and spend the night out, but not very often.
Now, were there any problems with the equipment you had? I'm thinking before you became colonel, you know, the standard of the Sexton self-propelled guns, the state they were in, and the ability to get supplies and fuel and the rest of it for them. Well, were there any sort of supply problems?
I personally didn't have any difficulty there at all, because we had this very good quartermaster, you see, and that was really his department.
But there were no shortages from above, imposed by government?
Well, of course, we couldn't get live ammunition. They wouldn't let us fire live ammunition at all, except for camp and things. But other than that, and there were times when petrol became a bit sticky, and we had to be careful not to overdo the things, because tanks and things are very extravagant on petrol.
And the tanks themselves were the self-propelled guns were in a decent state. I mean, they weren't...
Oh, yes, they weren't all flapped out or anything like that. And we had a very good maintenance staff in those days, really, you see. And we weren't sort of stuck with them all in pieces and that sort of thing.
Now, the next thing was we've now finally resolved that. In November 1949, after you'd been there with them 5 months, Barber handed over to Peter Birkin, mm-hmm. and Ivor Birkin, became second in command. Did that make a big difference to you when when Birkin took over, was he more hands-on than Barber had been?
You don't, well, I think he was, yes. But I guess now you mentioned 1949, I think that's probably what did happen. I joined just about at the time when Bill Barber was packing up.
It looks like there's a short period of thing.
That's why I really can't hardly remember the member of CO.
He was just for about 4 months, I think. Better next time. Now, are there any remaining comments you have about the way the regiment was run before you took over, or any instance you remember?
Well, there was very little of it. It started out from virtually nothing. See, they were very unfortunate. When that Nightingale battle happened, which they did so famous there, it pretty well annihilated the regiment. The people that weren't killed were put in the bag, and they hadn't got a proper second line regiment at that time at all, so there was nothing. So when they at the end of the war, when they started up again, they were starting from very, very slender resources.
They had 150 regiment.
Well, that was a heavy regiment. It was a bit divorced from the different technique altogether. And they had an enormous great gun. And that regiment more is to survive in the end. Well, I think it was withdrawn from the line, or whatever they call it. But I don't think we got much benefit from that at all, as far as I'm aware.
Now, one thing that happened was that they began to get their first national servicemen in 1950. What did you think of the quality of recruits that came in? That it was basically they were joining the regiment to complete their reserve liability, not after they'd served.
Yeah.
What did you think of them? The quality of material you got there.
On the whole, they were extremely good. And although they all grumbled about having to do national service, I never heard one single man say that it hadn't been the best thing that had happened to him. And they were a very great asset to the regiment, because we were getting recruits who were really trained soldiers. And it was a very good help. It illustrates the difference between the traditional TA, who's a fellow who comes off the streets and doesn't know how to march or anything, compared to the National Service recruit, who's a trained soldier. And it uplifted the efficiency of the regiment by a very good deal, I thought, in my opinion, anyway.
How long did they have to... how long was their reserve liability? How long would they have to continue to attend...
I think it was 2 years, wasn't it, or something like that.
And would they attend just as the normal territorials did?
Yes, they attend at the same time, one night a week and odd weekend. They would attend an ordinary member of the TA.
And would any of them continue voluntarily?
Some of them did, yes. Not too many, but some did.
Now, one thing that we haven't mentioned was the Rolleston Bowl for the best subsection in gun drill, and that was won by B subsection 425. Was that important, these internal competitions, for things like the Rolleston Bowl?
Well, there was just a bit of a carrot. There weren't the gun crews did vie with one another. They all thought they were better than the next man, so there was always a fair competition to win it, and to win anything. They still have the best gun competition now. It's always a very good thing to win. They all get a tank of each or something like that. It's some inducement. Most regiments have a lot of cups for people to win if they're good at anything, don't they? And that was just one of them.
As you went on, Peter Birkin handed over command temporarily to Ivor Birkin in 1952 for about 3 months, while he went, it seems to have gone for overseas service with the British Army overseas.
Yeah.
How was that period? I mean...
<Did it again? laughs> Now you can imagine the guy, I've forgotten that. You can imagine exactly how he felt when the final appointment was made.
So that made
having whetted his appetite, sort of thing.
How was he as colonel during those 3 months?
Well, exactly how I thought he'd be. Very impressed, well, naturally. But you see, when if we had a very, very good quartermaster and a very good adjutant, they were quite capable of carrying it on.
The next thing that's of note is that in 1952, at the annual camp in West Down, at Salisbury Payne, they had the Zed reservists out.
Yes.
Now, then they're different again. They're actual...
quite different.
Could they, you explain what they were and what they were like at the camp?
Well, they were the special reservists of people who had to do one camp. They had to come to a camp. And was it West Down?
Sure. It says Tilshead crossed out and West Down, so I don't know which one it is. Salisbury Plain, anyway.
I thought it was Waterbury, but anyway, they must have been West Down. It was a great success, this thing. The problem was finding employment for all the people we had, because we were over officers and over strength all through, and then we'd have a lot of people. But we managed to get them all fitted in one way or another. But it was quite a problem finding something for, because normally a battery has, I think, 12 officers when we're all together, and we found ourselves with sort of 16 or 17 officers in the battery, and it wasn't that easy to find something worthwhile doing, but they're reasonable people, these, you know, they were people who got good jobs and things. We didn't want to give them some stupid thing just to make it, given them something to do, and to find something worthwhile. And it wasn't that easy. But I think they all felt satisfied at the end of camp.
It was compulsory for them, wasn't it?
Absolutely, oh yes.
Did any of them seem unwilling or unkeen?
No, not a bit. They're all ex-army people, you see. They're all army people.
They'd served in the war, mostly.
Yes, yes.
Now, one thing, regimental sport. You've been keen on sport at school, but there's various references of Peter Birkin trying to form a rugby team, and then later on there seems to be some stuff about soccer. Was sport important to a territorial unit at all, or was it...
Well,
was there a cricket side? You know, I mean, would you have cricket sporting side?
We had a regular sergeant or sergeant regiment who was a cross-country runner,
but
on quite a big scale. But as far as sports go, I would say they were non-existent.
So it wasn't considered important to sort of build up that?
Not really, no, because it was so difficult to organise, because they'd all got their own, all these people, if they were cricketers, they were playing cricket for their local town or team or something, and really couldn't fit in the TA. The same as football. Any key footballer has got a team to play for.
Now, in 1953, various things happened. You were appointed second in command.
Yes.
It says Vice Major G.I. Barker. I don't know what it means in that context.
Oh, yes. Was that the time when Nigel Birkin was made colonel? I was made second in command.
Perhaps, it seems to be a bit, but Captain Foreman Hardy assumed command of 425 Battery. What was Foreman Hardy like?
I recruited him. He and I used to shoot together in Lincolnshire, and I bullied him into joining a thing. I really did, he was really hijacked.
Was he a good officer?
Very, yes. He was in the South Office one time, and he went into a mountain regiment. And he got wounded. He's a, he's an immensely wealthy man to start off with. He owned the Nottingham newspapers and half a brewery. So, you know, but he was a very self-effacing man, and we talked to him because we'd be getting to talk. It was never dream of the ramifications he has. He really had an active empire around, commercially. Well, I recently, he died, unfortunately. He had something awful happened to him. He went up the motorway on the wrong way, took it the wrong way up on the motorway, and had an awful accident, and he never really got over it. He stopped driving. Then he came down and finally died.
We'll come back perhaps to him. One thing that happens is the coronation of Elizabeth II, and there was a 21-gun salute fired from the castle. Now, do you remember that at all?
Oh, at the castle, yeah. I don't remember much about it, except that we had to get railway sleepers put on the lawn of the castle for the tanks to go on to. And we had to warn the hospital at the other end of the castle grounds to keep their windows open while we fired these things, in case they went off. And it went off very well.
A gun misfired? Was that a frequent thing?
Well, that could happen with blanks. I can't remember that happening. But if they said it, they didn't do it, obviously. But I can't remember that happening.
And what state would you say the unit was when you took over command? We've discussed how, because you were selected from above by the CRA. Now, who is the CRA? Could you just perhaps talk about that? Because you took over on the 12th of November.
Was it Wells?
It doesn't say, no.
I really can't remember.
But he was the one who selected you, was
he? Well, presumably, he or the general or somebody. Somebody I wasn't too really terrible. And when I took over, I tried to tighten things up a bit.
Now, was there any resentment in the regiment when Ivor Birkin didn't get it? Did anybody else also feel that he should have got it?
I think they probably thought I was a bit of an upstart. No, I think they respected me, actually, because I had then got to be a seriously, which I think helped quite a lot. I think they had a certain amount of respect for me, if nothing else. Now, that's all I expected, really.
So there was only Ivor Birkin who really took against you,
I would say he openly took against you, but obviously he was a very disappointed man, as you can imagine. And I would have been done all he'd done and everything else. And then suddenly Ivy walks in.
Did he stay with you long before he stood down?
I can't remember. I can't really remember. He didn't really have any impact at all, as far as I was concerned.